What's up, Gator Nation?
Good morning, Gator Nation.
You're listening to Gator Nation.
And the Gators have the biggest lead of the day.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WUMT.
From the University of Florida's College of Journalism and Communication.
3, 2, 1, we're live.
Hi, everyone. This is The Communicator, the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications podcast, where we dive into the latest in media, picking the brains of top faculty and staff around the Gator Nation. I'm Matt Abramson, Director of Media Services, with Sophia Abelfavi.
Happy to be here.
And Danny Burtless.
Also happy to be here.
Today, we're speaking with Tim Sorrell, a professor of media production, management, and technology, as well as the 2018 CJC International Teacher of the Year. Thanks for joining us, Tim.
Good morning.
So in 1987, we're going back a little bit, you earned your bachelor's degree in broadcasting from the University of Maine. Tell us what your time as an undergrad was like and what your career aspirations were back then.
Interesting question. So we're talking analog TV. And I actually started off as a theater lighting major. And I loved the theater, loved the ballet, loved the aspect of live performance and how light hit those performances. The hours were grueling. Being a lighting assistant meant you were working at 11 o'clock at night after rehearsals ended, working through the morning. And that got tiring. I still love light. I love what light does. I love what light does to set a mood. But especially in the theater, you can turn on a spotlight and everybody looks there and you can change the color. And just a bunch of things you can do with theater lighting. But the hours were rigorous. There was a job opening at the University of Maine, the public television station, much like we have here in Weimar Hall, was located right on the university. And they need a camera operator. And I didn't even know what that meant, you know, but I needed the hours and I wanted the job. And so I went over there and applied for the job and got the job. And then like they were doing a lighting session and I knew how to do all that stuff more so than some of the people they had working there. And I started doing all their lighting stuff. And so I found a gig there. But I also just fell in love with television and the ability to limit what the audience sees. Where in theater, you cannot limit them. You know, they're looking wherever they want to look. You have to really use lighting to get them where they're at. But with television and film, there's just no difference in that. And so that was sort of my beginning in changing majors and becoming what they call a broadcasting major. You wouldn't call it that today. But that was the beginning.
Excellent. And then in 1992... you produced an Emmy-nominated film titled Women, Children, and AIDS. What was the subject matter, and what were the challenges producing a story with such a sensitive topic?
You have to remember that it was the Reagan administration. During that particular time, there was almost a denial of what was going on in the country and how AIDS was devastating people, and it was seen as a homosexual disease. And homosexuality was just not widely accepted during that time period. That particular documentary, we found 5 women that had contracted HIV through heterosexual sex. So it was the first film of its kind, really. It aired on public broadcasting to a nationwide audience. And it really educated people that AIDS was something, or HIV and AIDS was something that the entire country needed to get involved with. And I think that film helped. I really do.
Was it difficult finding your subjects and developing that story? I mean, I feel like a health documentary in general would be sort of sensitive to their thoughts and feelings as you're telling their story. This felt, I mean, in my mind, this seems like it might be another like a layer of more difficulty to properly tell the story, but also be very sensitive to sharing their perspective as they're going through it.
Actually, it wasn't incredibly difficult to find the subjects. It was filmed in Maine, and all the subjects were from Maine. So you wouldn't think of Maine as being a populous state. I remember there was an organization called the Eastern Maine AIDS Network that was starting to, like, people were contracting this disease. They didn't know where to turn. You know, you go to a hospital or doctor, not a whole lot of people knew anything about this. And so this network of advocacy began. And so finding the subjects was actually not difficult because the disease was so rapidly infecting the country.
Were they hoping that them sharing their stories helped the greater good, the population, to know what they're dealing with and going through? Or was there another sense of what they were hoping to achieve by participating?
No, I think you hit it right on the head there. I think they wanted to know that this was everybody's disease. There was no treatment. And they knew that they were terminal. And so I think they very, very bravely came forward And as a documentary filmmaker, let me invade their lives. In one case, one of the subjects had a daughter who contracted HIV through birth, which again was unheard of. The daughter survived, but everybody else in the film had passed. But you know, they were brave. They were brave to come forward, sit down, be candid, and tell us their stories, and let us become part of their lives. And so, I think when documentary film is done right, it can indeed change the way we perceive, you know, health, perceive politics, or perceive racism. And so that's one of the passions I always had in my career was like, what can I do that's going to move the dial on a perhaps a sensitive subject?
Excellent. So after graduation, you began working at WVII-TV, which is Bangor's Fox affiliate station. How did you get your foot in the door? And what roles did you hold and what kind of projects were you working on there?
I actually started at the public broadcasting station in Bangor, went to the CBS affiliate, got recruited to the NBC affiliate. Then I had my own business for a while. And then that's when I went to the Fox affiliate after that. So I have the unique role, if you will, of working in all four television stations in Bangor, Maine at one time or another, mostly as a college student, but then later on. So actually getting my foot in the door there was not very difficult. They came after me. They needed a production manager. They were looking to do X, Y, and Z. They knew my production company, and they wanted to know if I would house my production company within their facility. And so, yeah, that's how that came about.
And were you doing documentaries right at the gate? Were you doing TV shows, commercial? Like, what was the
scope? I was doing a little bit of everything, really, in the private sector. I would take on industrials. I would take on commercials, some documentary. I think I spent a lot of my time during that period of my life on the road doing a lot of sports television as well. Live events at the Boston Garden, live events at Fenway Park, the old Schaefer Stadium, which where the Patriots used to play at. So I just had a lot of things going on career-wise, trying to pay bills. You know, sometimes the production situation dictates what is on tap for your rent that month. And not always the funnest of jobs that I would take, but I would take them to pay rent. I always loved it, but some jobs were more satisfying than others. But I always genuinely enjoyed the work, no matter what it was.
So in 2005, you earned your MBA from St. Louis University. What inspired you to return to the classroom and why an MBA?
At that particular time, I had moved to Florida, and I was the operations director for Diversified Communications. They wanted me to become vice president and station manager up in Myrtle Beach, one of the properties that they owned. And they said, we really want you to get your master's degree in business. And so that's how that came about. But I didn't decide like to go back to the classroom. It was sort of decided for me. It was paid for me, which is wonderful. After that, I took another turn and opened up another production company. I decided not to move to Myrtle and to become a station manager. I would have had a very different life, a nice life, but a very different life. I was not ready to come out from behind the camera or stop doing production or the challenges of production or stop filmmaking to be a GM, which really is concerned about sales and expenses and spreadsheets, right?
Yep.
You're worried about the money coming in. And I think that was the best move for me.
Was that a difficult choice to take a maybe more uncertain path instead of what would have been a life very laid out for you had you worked at the studio?
I think it was really a difficult choice. I just followed my heart. You know, I think coming out of what I love to do was the more difficult decision early on, and then traipsing down to a weekend master's program, much like the one we have here at Florida, to earn my master's degree over the course of 2 years, part-time, still working full-time. That was more difficult. But when I made the decision that, you know, I was going to yet open another production company, had clients, had TV shows already under contract, that actually became quite easy. You know, I just followed my passion. I always advise people to do that. Be happy at work.
Hey, this is Danny. You founded Studio 601 with Travis Chapman. What was the mission of the production unit and what need does it serve in North Central Florida?
Studio 601 was started as a Gainesville, Central Florida production company. Mostly, we had a pretty good contract to do a show for Fox Sports, Sun Sports. It was called Sun Sports at the time. And that concerned the Florida football team and concerned the Florida men's basketball team and maybe 10 other broadcasts that we would put on, like live broadcasts for other sports. And so there was definitely a contract there to be had. Like sometimes production companies get formed out of the client relationship. You find a big client, you need to form a company and start putting this together. And so that's really how that came about. There was this niche in Florida sports that needed to be filled. We had the right amount of experience as far as sports production plus documentary production, which that show required, or that series of shows required. And so that's Studio 6-1 was then born. Originally, it was called Katahdin Productions. Katahdin is a mountain in Maine. We were both from Maine, and we found out nobody in Florida could pronounce the name Katahdin. So we stopped calling it Katahdin Productions and renamed it. We were going to call it Power Play Digital because of my affection for hockey, but when we understood nobody in Florida understands hockey, at least they didn't at the time. So we came up with the name Studio 601. It doesn't really mean anything. 601 was kind of like a digital video space at the time. So you were recording 601 kilobits per second, which is nothing today. But back then, that was it, mm-hmm. 601 kilobits. And so we called it Studio 601, and that was the reason. And so sometimes we would make a joke that, you know, my favorite number was 6 and Travis's was 01. And that's how we came about 601. But there's really no meaning in the name.
I was hoping it was an area code.
No, it wasn't. And that would have been a better reason. I could have explained it that way. So I think at one point on the Studio 6-1 website, it said the name itself doesn't make any, you know, we just named it this because we did. Don't try to make anything up from it. We were going to change the name yet again. This was earlier on, maybe our first year of business. We were thinking about the name, really wasn't what we wanted. We weren't quite sure about it. And we had entered a bunch of things in the Addies, the local advertising competition here. And that particular first Addies, we won like 17 awards. So it was like all night long, it was such and such advertising agency in Studio 601. At the time, there was another advertising agency in town called Group 5 Advertising and Studio 601. It was just all night long. So the entire advertising community here in Ocala and Gainesville was, who are these guys? And that's when we just, okay, the name's got to stick now. You know, we threw ourselves out there. We won all these awards. It's time for it to stick.
It'd be too much to pay to redo all those trophies at that point. So in 2006, you directed Gridiron Gators, a documentary about the Florida Gators. Tell us about producing a 90-minute film on such a storied history of Gator football.
Really, the credit on the background on that film really goes to UAA's Dennis Black. He is very passionate about Florida football. He was brand new to the UAA at the time. And, you know, for his opportunity to film some of these Gator greats really was the heartbeat of that film. It was something that we had to bid on. There was a competitive process between, I think, probably 6 or 7 companies. We were local, so we had a little bit of an edge. And Warner Brothers Home Video jumped in on that, and they had agreed to distribute it. So the stakes are fairly high. And we put a bid process together and were interviewed, and Dennis decided that we were the guys that he wanted to work with. We were local. We were ready to go. We were fired up. We were at every football game to begin with. And he just became very familiar with us with him. So I really have to give the credit to of the success of Gridiron Gators to Dennis for his passion to hunt all these people down. And these Gator greats were not easy to come by. We had to camp out at the University Hilton in order to get an interview with Emmett Smith. We were there all day. Emmett just doesn't do interviews, period. And that's the only time Dennis and I ever really got in a fight on the film was I said, we have to sit here all day for an interview with Emmett Smith. And he looked at me and he said, yes. And I had touched the stove, and Dennis has a very long fuse. But I upset him that day because he knew what a key interview that was. And he knew that Emmett doesn't do interviews. And if we had any chance of doing that, we better be at his hotel. And sure enough, a very famous Gator alumni, the late, great Stumpy Harris, came in with Emmett. And Dennis said, Emmett, can you come to this interview? 5 minutes. Of course, we lied. It's going to be longer than 5 minutes. But And then Stumpy and Emmett's like, I don't know. I really don't. But I get taught my age. But, and Stumpy's, you should do this. It's the 2006, you know, 100-year floor. You should do this. You should do this. And he did it. We were set up in a room at the Hilton that like a little like a conference room was all, it was lit. It was ready to go. He said, and once he got into the flow of the interview, he gave us a lot of time because DB had really, Dennis Black had really prepared his questions about games that Emmett had broken records. And then Emmett kind of got into the flow of what that was all about. We were really honoring him and his place in Florida football history. So, yeah. Yeah. But that also helped put 261 on the map in a lot of ways. So, you know, was nominated for an Emmy, didn't win. I'm not bitter. Okay, I am. I'm a bitter old man. Yeah, that did extremely well. It sold well through Warner Home Video. And another group called Star Games was also involved in that distribution deal. It's funny how many people get their hands on something when you deal with collegiate properties. But, I learned a lot from the film, and I'm glad I have the poster in the wall in my office still. It was a great ride. It was a great ride to meet all those great Gators and to have that experience.
And seeing the credits, you had a dream team. I mean, Dennis, yourself, Travis, Gator Bill, I think was your writer. Mm-hmm. So that was, and to do something that important to the university, I feel like that's just a feather in the cap to not just get the bid, but like to own that project. That's awesome.
Yeah. There was a musician and Kevin, gosh, I can't remember his last name. He was a music professor in the College of Music. And he was a pianist. He was leaving the university, and I just happened to catch him. And I said, listen, I need some custom piano work done for the end. So if you listen to the Gridiron Gators at the very end, Danny Werfel's getting kind of teary-eyed. And so we really recorded it right at University Auditorium. I went in there with some recording gear, mic'd up the piano, and I had my laptop playing Danny's comments back in his ears. And he started playing this little, we are the boys of old Florida, that little riff. Mm-hmm. But he did it in such a way, like if you listen to it, you'll start tearing up. And then he did some other riffs, and he just kind of, he just watched the whole end of the movie and just kind of kept playing along. So the last 3 or 4 minutes were just custom composed. And shame on me for not remembering his last name, but he was brilliant. So yeah, it was nice to be here and to have some of those local connections to the local sports writers, to the university archives with all the old press clippings, the old Gator pennants and Gator pins, and before the Gators were the Gators, and to go into the university archives, and they have lockers full of this stuff where you can access and take photographs of that type of thing, I think just really helped add to the visuals of that film. So yeah, I think the Gainesville connection really helped us.
Speaking of Gainesville connection, in 2007, you began teaching at U.S. College of Journalism and Communications. What drew you to academia, and what courses did you start with, and what do you teach now?
In 2007, John Wright, who was the dean of the College of Journalism and Communications at the time, came to the premiere of Gridiron Gators. We had it at Emerson Hall. Pretty big deal. Big screen, sound, chairs, alumni, dignitary as the president of the university was there, athletic director Jeremy Foley. I mean, just the entire crew was there, like 350 people, big event. And John was there. And John approached me and said, I have an opening in the college for someone like you. And I didn't want to teach college. It was intriguing, but I saw myself as a working professional, not a teacher. And how would that affect? So I was very flattered. That he had asked me. And then another faculty member at the time, her name was Cindy Hill, called me about 2 days before the applications were due. And they said, we were on the impression you were going to apply for this. And I wasn't going to apply for it. I had no, and the last day I threw my materials in, very last day. I came here, did the interview process, and I met some cool people. Didn't meet any students, I wish I had. But I thought, okay, this is potential. Again, Gridiron is struggling. Like, it's there. Sales are okay, but it's struggling. The 2008 recession also hit about the same time. Okay. And so now we've got this production company we've started. Revenues are soft. Gridiron's not doing as well as it could have done. It was soon to take off. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to go take this teaching gig, not thinking I was going to be here more than a year. That's the honest to God truth. The things that a professor has to go through to get creative tenure is extraordinarily difficult process. 5 films in 5 years. That's a lot. You know, so I never saw myself doing that. I never saw myself being able to be successful at that. I thought it was just going to be a grueling, nearly impossible schedule to do. The very first classes I taught were Fundamentals of Production and Senior Workshop. I found the curriculum at the time was very unbalanced. There wasn't a lot of direction to the production curriculum. And I found out also I was the only production person here. That was it. It was me. And so started, I like the challenge of building a curriculum. I like the challenge of starting from scratch with these senior classes and what did it need? And what did we need for equipment? And John Wright was very good about funding some of those initiatives. We needed some camera. Like we had 87 kids in the program at the time. Today it's more than 300, but we had 87 in the program and six functioning cameras, and functioning was barely functioning. Maybe four of them worked at any given time. And I said, John, you know, we're going to make some investment in this or you're not going to be successful. And he did. But yeah, my first classes were Fundamentals of Production, the very first class that most students saw. And then I had like a senior workshop that eventually would work itself into what I teach now, which is advanced post-production using, we use character generator. We use, a character animator, Adobe Photoshop, Illustrator, and After Effects. So I teach an advanced post-production class now. My other class I'm currently teaching is in the graduate division, digital audiovisual storytelling for communications professionals earning their master's degree. So that's what I'm doing now.
Excellent. And on top of that, you're also still staying busy doing documentary work. So how did you conceive of the 2011 documentary, The Trap of Saving Cambodia? And what were some of the standout moments from that production?
I first went to Cambodia with a gentleman who lives in town here named Richard Allen. A lot of people know Richard. He's a strong supporter of public broadcasting here. Famous businessman in town, does a lot of startup businesses, and founded a company called RTI, which is now publicly traded. He's no longer involved in that. So anyway, Richard Allen's a business star in Gainesville. He approaches me at the Rotary Club, and which I was a member of at the time, and he said, "You're a storyteller, visual storyteller. Would you mind coming and telling the story of what I'm trying to do in Cambodia?" And he had an NGO called Sustainable Cambodia, trying to help, you know, impoverished citizens of that country into an education model, into a health model. And he wanted that story told, mostly I think for fundraising, and he was willing to pay my way to Cambodia. And I'm like, that sounds like a good time. I'd never been that far out of the country. I'd been to some different countries through work. Going into rural Cambodia was like, I might as well be walking off the planet, but I wanted to do it. I just really wanted to do it. So it was me, a DVX-100, a tripod, and a couple of microphones, and off I am in Cambodia. So that's how that came about. I was just making videos for this guy's NGO, his well program, his education program, what they were trying to do with sustainability and trying to get people involved in the workforce, microloans. Not a new model. There's a lot of development organizations that help small countries. But he was copying some of that, and he went into this very rural section of Cambodia and started this program. It's still running today. When I got there, I noticed a lot of things about Cambodia and the way that a lot of organizations like Richard's go in and tries to fix the country. It ultimately, you have to be very careful what you're getting involved in there. A lot of people go to Cambodia and they fall in love with it. And they give it all kinds of money. And how far has that gotten them? So ultimately, I don't think Richard was happy with my film, because I'm not telling people do not give to these organizations that support Cambodia. What I am saying is that if you're going to have real change, then they can't become part of the Cambodian government's system of corruption. And it's just corruption. It's built into budgets. It's built into NGO budgets. We have to pay this person. We have to pay that person. And it's just this kind of, and so that's what that film is about, really. There's a human trafficking aspect to it, you know, just horrible things I saw of young women being prostituted. And like when I say young women, I mean girls, and just revolting. And I don't even like thinking about it, to be honest with you. But I just saw a lot of things that good things that could go on in the country. But I just want, as people go into Cambodia and you think you're going to save it, be and I didn't come up with the title. It was a very, very famous author named Lynn Becker, who did a lot of work in Cambodia during the whole Pol Pot regime, the fall of Cambodia and the Pol Pot takeover and then the fall of Pol Pot. She was a journalist at the time, and she's based in Washington, D.C. for The Washington Post. And she interviewed for film, and she said, you know what, you have to be careful. Beware of the trap of trying to save Cambodia. And I was like, oh, there's my title. Because it was the center, really the center point of the film. So yeah, that's how that came about. And it was used, The Trap of Saving Cambodia was used by the Committee on Foreign Relations. They showed parts of it at several meetings. And it really helped to realign, at least somewhat under the Obama administration, how we were interacting with Cambodia. And I was told that when Hillary Clinton went in as Secretary of State, to that her speech was part of that came out of the film. Like when she went in and talked about human rights and what we're going to do and what we're not going to do, somebody at State had told me that your film was instrumental in helping us with this. So
that's amazing to make art that actually has such a direct impact to like current geopolitical issues.
I didn't think it was going to do that at the time. You know, I was in human rights film festivals. I wanted people to see it, of course. That's why I made it. I didn't know that was going to happen. So did it make it to Cannes? No. Was it at South by Southwest? No. Or Tribeca or some other film festival, which I had hoped for and didn't get in, probably just because of lack of funding for this. Like I find myself, I am the king of the underfunded documentary. Like I can go with nothing and still make something. But that starts to show at that level when you're trying to get into huge festivals. But yeah, no, it did something amazing that I wasn't expecting. And so I'm glad I did it.
Perfect segue.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue into this question, which is, how do you fund independent projects like The Trap of Saving Cambodia?
Well, that one you walked us through. So in general, how would you approach this?
Getting independent documentaries funded is an extraordinarily difficult process. So first you ask everybody you know. I think it's important to try to find a niche. If you find a niche and you can appeal to an audience that is into that niche, probably makes more sense for some of my other films. But the Cambodian film itself, some of the funding came from this college. Some of the funding came from a human rights organization called the Bellingham Independent Film Festival Fund. I drew some funds from them. I paid for some of that one out of my pocket, to be honest with you. So I managed to cobble together enough grant money to pay for flights and hotels. Everything else was probably out of pocket on that particular documentary. But I think for the most part, I've had great success in finding people that were passionate enough about that particular topic to give me a check. And the checks are, obviously, it's a little easier when you have the University of Florida name attached to it and the University of Florida Foundation attached to it. That speaks volumes, a 501c3. And people can give to the University of Florida Foundation, and I can put that right into funding of production. So that's how I've been doing it, but it's really just trying to find that right audience fund your project.
I'm Glenn Richards from WUFT Amplified. If you're like me, you appreciate how special the local music scene is here in North Central Florida, featuring indie rock, hip-hop, bluegrass, and so much more. WUFT Amplified is Florida's music series, filmed right here in Weimer Hall. This show rocks, guys, seriously. And you might not realize that WUFT Amplified is produced entirely by UFCJC staff and students. To watch past episodes and discover your new favorite bands, check out WUFT.org/amplified.
So this is Sophia here again. You mentioned that you develop a niche within your filmmaking, and your niche are somewhat tough subjects that are either underserved populations or underrepresented. And so when telling these sorts of stories, how do you manage your own biases and emotions in the filmmaking?
It's not easy, to be quite honest. I think I have a very bad habit of falling in love with my subjects, especially kids, and getting so wound up in that that I start finding them doctor's appointments that might be impossible for them to get, but I can get. That's what I did this morning. Sometimes I know if a family's struggling, I'll go and get them a gift certificate at a grocery store or something, just because I've developed a relationship with that. So I wouldn't say that it's a bias per se, but more of a passion for trying to help. And I see their situation. I see what they're doing. I'm seeing them, like, I'm trying to tell their story because I think it's going to help them. If it doesn't help them, it might help another family that's affected with the same thing. And I got to try to keep that out there. But at the same time, they're suffering right in front of me. And it's tough. It's very, very tough not to get wrapped up emotionally in that. And but I've tried. I've actually been counseled by other filmmakers and then health professionals about keeping boundaries. Like, you've got to keep a boundary. You've got to be able to check that and leave it at the door and not let it come into your personal life. But I think as a passionate filmmaker, like, it's hard not to. It's your film. It's what you're doing to get across a certain specific message to a population. And I will say this. It is very, very difficult to not put your own biases and passions into film. It just is. But I do think that can be a mark of a great filmmaker too.
Speaking of boundaries, I think a lot of aspiring documentarian and filmmakers are curious, what is the ethical balance that you have to strike capturing the story, but maybe not pushing too hard? You know, if you're interviewing a parent of a sick child, they start crying. Do you keep pushing? Do you stop at that point? I'm sure it depends on the situation, but what are those boundaries?
I think long before that, for people who, like Sophia or beginning documentary filmmakers, you have to create a relationship with your subject first. Long before you get to that interview stage, they have to have some sense of trust. And with that, you start to learn when to push. So if I have a subject that's emotional, and chances are they will be because that's the type of work I do, I usually will lay out, and there's an art to it. I actually have examples I teach my documentary classes, my storytelling classes, where I'm asking a question and I can feel the subject's ready to go and they're getting emotional. And I'll just kind of pause and let them have that moment. And then I'll see where they want to go. Now, they may wave off. They may wave their hands and say, like, I've got to stop. But I won't stop the interview ever. I'll just sit there and I'll just look at them and just with sympathetic eyes, make eye contact and let them know it's okay. It's okay. You know, it's okay to be emotional. It's okay to tell me. And I would say 9 times out of 10, they'll continue. They'll continue to kind of on that thought process. So my advice to young filmmakers is know when to lay out. Just lay out. Don't ask the next question. Don't stop the interview. Don't say it's okay. Don't say, we can come back to that. Just don't say anything. Just make eye contact and see where they want to go next. And for the most part, those are the most powerful sound bites in certain films. The ethical part of that comes in if a subject calls you back and says, I don't want that in the film. Now it's kind of like, depending on who you are, I'm not that kind of producer that's going to say, I've got it, I'm using it. You know, we see a lot of people like that, right? I won't mention news organizations or other filmmakers that, but there are aggressive producers and aggressive directors that are like, you know, sue me.
Yeah,
you know,
I've got it. That's my story. I'm going with it.
But for me, that would break the trust I've built. And so, but very rarely do people call me back and say, I don't want you to use something. Very rarely. But I typically would. I've earned their trust. I've worked on them. They're giving me this passionate story. I have to try to honor what they want and how they want to be presented on screen. You have to know that most people that are in a documentary are going to hate themselves on TV. They just hate, they look at them like, that's how I look. That's how I sound. Like, you know, they, and so I try to get them prepared for that too early on that, you know, don't watch this. Like, don't watch this. You know the story. You don't need to watch this. But yeah, that's a great question, Matt. I try to coach young people into, you want to be sensitive, but it's your job as a storyteller to get the story. And so I think it's a case-by-case basis of, just trying to be sensible. But getting back to relationships, if you don't have the relationship with your subject, that's a hard one to figure out. So make the relationship. Let them know that you're passionate about the story, you're passionate about their story. And I think the rest just works itself out.
And then zooming out, what's your process for producing a documentary, including the pre-production development, just kind of bird's eye view of if you have a new project in your lap, how are you starting? How do you build from that, like, get go? You got greenlit now.
Well, nothing's ever greenlit until you have money. And so I tend to be greenlit well before I ever have any money. And so there's a new story that just dropped into my lap, something I'm actually working with Sophia on. But there's a story beyond that just came up of this parent who lost a child to cancer and now travels to a hospital to educate doctors on how to speak to parents that have terminally ill children, or the child may be lost to cancer. And so that's the first program of its kind, right? So I think that's an interesting premise. First program of its kind, not been doing. It can't educate other people, other hospitals, other doctors to say, we have to have better bedside manner when we deal with parents. We can't just tell parents, oh, I'm sorry, your child died, and out the door they go. We have to take care of the whole body. So that's a very interesting premise for me.
And then she personifies that by being a parent who's lost a child. Yeah.
But so does the person running the program at the hospital, right? And then the admin above that, and then the other parents who I've not met yet. But my premise is there. Like, I've already sort of picked that out as my next project. It shoots in one city, which makes it a lot easier than doing the one I'm working on right now. And so I've kind of already earmarked that as I've already greenlit it. Will I find money for it? I don't know. But at that point, you start asking everybody in that universe, this is what I'm trying to do. Do you want to help me make a movie? And you can't be shy. And a lot of times you're going to get no. Even with the University of Florida's name behind it. And this is the way the money gets spent. It gets spent on travel and production only. I don't make a dime. So that's my sales pitch. I'm doing this because it's a passionate project for me. Would you please help me out with this? You know, and then I have done some crowdsource funding and have been pretty successful at that, but I try not to. Usually the things I do for the parents I'm trying to help, I see a lot of $10 and $15 gifts and I know they're trying to give, and that's the person that I don't want to take the money from. You know, I want to find somebody that's a philanthropist and can afford to help fund a project that's going to, you know, further the mission of health, children's health, and children's literacy, the things that I work on.
We also briefly want to discuss your 2017 film, My Kid Is Not Crazy. Obviously, mental health is so upfront right now in our culture. Tell us about that story and how you formed a relationship with those participants.
Well, the short version of that story is my sister was terminally ill. She had met an attorney and she wanted to put her will together. And this attorney had a child with this and wrote a book about it. And my sister kept putting this book in front of me. And I was working on something for PBS that's also in my Vita called Lifecasters. I was in Texas, Laredo, Texas, shooting this. And my sister kept like texting me, you got to read this book. You got to read this book. I just didn't have time to, it wasn't on my radar to start a new film. But I eventually picked up the book and I read about this particular disease called PANDAS, pediatric autoimmune psychiatric disorders associated with streptococcal infection. So a kid gets strep and all of a sudden the next day they're psychotic. Well, how could this be? Undiagnosed strep infection. So that whole premise intrigued me. So I went to they were having an educational conference in Providence, Rhode Island in 2013. And I went and I started meeting parents, started talking to parents. And there was two parents outside trying to write a petition to change a law in Massachusetts so that these kids would get the not only the health care they needed, but there's a couple of treatments that are fairly expensive. And insurance companies routinely denied this. So these two parents, two school teachers in Massachusetts, had no business with legislation, right? Like no business trying to fight the insurance lobby or fight the legislature, try to get insurance coverage for these kids. And I said, well, what are you doing this for? And they said, well, we had our pediatrician, our rheumatologist, our immunologist, psychiatrist, all said that this child needed this particular treatment and the insurance company said no. And I said, that's criminal, right? You got six doctors from different disciplines from noteworthy Boston hospitals, not just some clinician somewhere, but noteworthy hospitals all saying this kid needs this treatment. I know it costs $8,000 and that's a lot of money, but how does the insurance company have a right to veto that? And so that was my all-in moment on that particular film. I'm going to dig into this. Now, I did not know it was going to take 4 years. I would have probably rethought it. But trying to get to the bottom of all this insurance company decisions, trying to get to the bottom of the disease. It wasn't really a disease until like 1993, which is actually not that old when you think about diseases and the acceptance of the medical community. And so there was a lot to that particular movie. And so beginning to end, I decided that I needed to get in with families that were right in the midst of this. You could meet families that I've been dealing with for 4 or 5 years, but I wanted the ones that were just new to this disease. My child was good last week, and now look at them. And so those parents are very, very frail. The brothers and sisters are frail. The kid's frail, right? And so that took a little while to identify those characters and people that were willing. I mean, I was on a moment's notice, get on a plane and go. A camera and another guy and another camera and let's go. Let's see what happens. It was like that kind of thing. One-way plane tickets because we didn't know when we were coming back, right? Just trying to figure out and trying to get these interviews with these parents. So that worked out pretty well. But my all-in moment was in 2013. It's like, you know, this is criminal what's happening. That film, My Kid Is Not Crazy, went on to win an Emmy. It won the highest award you can win from the Broadcast Education Association, amongst like 1,700 entries, it got the very, very top award of that festival. So I'm pretty proud of that. But I didn't do it for awards, but it did win a couple, which is, it's nice to have your peers recognize you, for that particular work. But I do think it helped move the needle on pandas and pans and what it is. Amazon Prime picked it up. We got 2.3 million unique views, which means that a unique household picked it up and watched it at least past the halfway point. So when they start clicking those particular numbers, you knew it hit a lot of people. And that ran on Amazon Prime for 2 years. And some network has it too. I can't remember. It's like a small cable network has it. God, I should know these things. But I don't. But they're still running it today. They run it every once in a while. I'll get it something on Facebook or social media. Say, hey, I just saw your film again. Like, if it made it in 2018, what's it still doing playing today? But it does. And now the film, it just lives for free on YouTube. I just put it out on YouTube Space for anybody to watch it. And it's got some pretty good worldwide play. I haven't checked it in a while. Maybe 50,000-60,000 hits of unique views from around the world.
And counting, everyone, go watch it.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you gauge the success of your projects? You have these metrics, festivals, awards, whatever, but what does your success mean to you?
Wow, great question. I think in the end, I want to sit back and watch it and I want to be touched emotionally, even though I'm very close to the subject matter. And I want to sit back and say, that was good. It had a strong premise, had strong characters, something people can be passionate about and learn something from. And that's my metric. You know, if it goes on to win awards, great, you know, but like a lot of the stuff I do a lot of shorts too. I do a lot of 8-10 minute shorts about new surgical treatments. Did a great film about these school teachers that are trying to move the needle for kids that don't speak English out in Williston. That was just a local thing. Department of Education used it, but it didn't go anywhere really. It wasn't like part of a festival circuit, but teachers use that around the country to come up with new methods of trying to get students to read in English that don't speak English as their native language. That's a challenge. So I think as long as I think it's serving a purpose, I'm happy with it. But I'm not going to lie, when your peers give you an award, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool moment. But I don't think it's the pinnacle for me. I think you could live a life of disappointment if you're hoping something wins an award. But getting people to see it, I think, is my biggest kick. Having people reach out and say, I saw that. That was amazing. Or people, you know, come up randomly at these different events and say, wow, that film moved me. Or I get an email from somebody and said, that changed our lives. You know, that's really the bigger kick.
And Sophia is producing another documentary that's going to air on WFT this summer. Danny's producing short films already, and you're just here at the CJC, like a couple semesters in, right?
That's correct.
So, Tim, you know, with like no budget or very small budgets, what advice do you have for these aspiring filmmakers that maybe they can't find funding right out the gate, but how do they keep making a difference in telling these important stories?
Well, first of all, as students at the University of Florida, Danny, I'm taking it you're a production student?
Yes, I am.
Okay, what year?
I'm a sophomore.
And what classes are you going to take?
So currently I'm looking to take fundamentals next semester.
Okay. All right. So with fundamentals, and then you'll have EFP one after that, and Sophia's in some of these classes as well. My advice is that take advantage of what we have for you. We got a lot of equipment. We got a lot of gear. And so gear is going to be your biggest, one of your biggest things. You know, use it. Use it. Take advantage of it. The best filmmakers that have come out of this college were always shooting every weekend, every night. Blew off a lot of classes. I'm not going to lie, but they were always out doing something. And they were always trying to put something together. So depending on your genre, you know, you have a lot of free access to things here. You're also in a community with some other passionate filmmakers, you know, that know, they know how to recognize taking advantage of an opportunity. And so getting other people excited about your film is very important. All right. You know, reaching into the acting pool. I'm thinking you work in fictional storytelling or?
Currently, I do.
All right,
yes.
current fiction. So reaching into the actors pool over at the College of Theater and learning who the professors are over there and working that community and say, hey, I got this great script. So first of all, you're always selling. If you want to do a film and you got no money, that's fine, but you're always in sell mode. I have a great film. This is what it's about. Know your elevator pitch and go get other people excited about it. Actors want to act. They'll work for free if they think you know you've got your affairs in order. I wanted to cuss, but I guess I probably should on the podcast. But you have, if you have your act together and you can get other people excited, and when you get those actors to set, make sure you're ready to go. I think a lot of young filmmakers make that mistake. They're so into X, Y, and Z that they get these pro actors or even just acting students on the set, and then the crew is a little disorganized. The actors are working for free. They get frustrated. So avoid all that. Make sure you're good at your equipment. You know how to use it. Make sure that you're clear in your pre-pro. You've walked through your entire sets that you plan on shooting that day, your lighting challenges. You've worked this out, practice shooting. A lot of students don't want to practice shooting. They don't want to, they just want to go out and do it. And they're not good enough to tell you got to practice. Right. And, you know, stick to your mission. But I would say that there are so many films, especially great student films that go on to win really high awards and get noteworthy and get people into film school that have zero budgets. Yeah, you might have to pop $40 for the pizzas or whatever, but, you know, welcome to our world. But financing is really, really super difficult. But I don't think as a student you really have to. I think you can dig in here and use the resources of what we have to get a film made. But it's about relationships, with crew. Hey, come out and shoot this for me, Sophia. She's pretty good. I'd ask her to come and DP something for me. And relationships with actors. There's people want to act. The stand-up comedians that do stand up on campus, Theater Strike Force, people like that, they want to act. So get them excited, but just have your affairs in order. Know your script, know what you want to do, and stay on mission. And I think, and we have editing facilities here, so I think there's a lot here you can do for free and get attention for your film.
Awesome, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Communicator Podcast is a production of UF's College of Journalism and Communications. This episode was produced by Sophia Abelfavi and Danny Bertless. Thank you to our guest, Tim Sorrell, hosted by Matt Abramson and featuring Sophia Abelfavi and Danny Bertless. Special thanks to WUFT. Go Gators!